I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Here, we will discuss the mysteries of the universe. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast or in a car coming home from the beach or listening in your bed as you fall asleep, you are about to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you are going than you thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. Tonight, we are going to discuss in our cosmology section the Hollow Earth theory. This is one of the most fascinating subjects on, or should I say, in the planet. And there is much more to this story than people think. I would also like to tell you that there is a scientific expedition planned for next summer that is designed to discover and divulge the truth. We're going to discuss the evidence collected so far, and as always, we invite your comments via the chat function available on bbsradio.com for the program tonight. Just go to the X Squared Radio link, and we'll get you there. I'm also going to respond to critics of my theory that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. Some of you wrote in, you didn't believe that was so. Many of you have heard of the observation effect, which is particularly important to we physicists. Well, you are going to learn some more about it tonight, maybe from a completely different perspective. And we will also discuss the impact of the recent explosion of X-class solar flares and why this is so contrary to what solar physicists are expecting at this time. We'll examine what this means for the future. In our Nephilim section tonight, we're going to discuss the mark of the beast. In generations past, it would have been impossible to force America to accept such a mark, or Americans to accept such a mark. Well, what we once abhor, we soon tolerate and now embrace. Tonight, you will find out how the technology has been perfected and why we will so willingly accept this mark. This is perhaps the most intelligent and well-planned subjugation of a population in the history of the world. As always, if you would like to participate in tonight's program, you can reach me instantly by going to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Click on the X Squared Radio link and access the show through the Harmony Live chat room. You don't have to identify yourself. You don't have to give us any information about yourself at all to use this chat room. This is much faster than email, and no one is ever put on hold. I will follow your comments live on the radio and respond as I am inspired. If you ever wanted your voice and your thoughts to be addressed on Global Radio, this is your chance. As we expand the program, we will add toll-free phone access so your thoughts and your voice can be heard throughout the universe. This is the most important subject material in the universe, so you might as well participate. Remember who you are, and let's get ready to enter X Squared Radio. Now, one thing I need to tell you tonight is that, unfortunately, out in California, where our server is located, they are currently having some technical difficulties. We don't really know why. It couldn't have anything to do with all of the X-class solar flares we have had in the last couple of weeks, since the 5th of month. But It should go all right later on in the show. The website should be back up and running. As soon as it is, just keep trying throughout the show, then you'll be able to participate. And we're going to have some specials, which we will extend for the rest of the evening and into tomorrow, so that you can take advantage of it. The Arc of Millions of Years, which is my co-author E.J. Clark and mine's newest book, is the greatest story on the universe. Volume 1 solves the mystery of evolution and creation once and for all. In its 530 pages, you will learn about the origin and destiny of the Earth. You will learn about the ancient giants. You will learn about man's long history of interaction with off-worlders. You will learn the common origin of many of mankind's most powerful religious symbols. When you are done with that book, you will never look at the stars, your scriptures, or yourself the same again. At www.arcofmillionsofyears.com or in your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstore. All right, we begin our cosmology section tonight. It's going to take a couple of twists, and we'll try to make it as esoteric and scientific at the same time. I stated once a long time ago, about 30 years ago, everything we do will eventually affect the universe. Several years later, I added an additional phrase, do it on purpose. This is my slogan. Some of you took issue with this, so I thought I would address that tonight. In physics, we often speak of the observation effect. That means when we look at things in the quantum world, the very small world, the atomic world, we must use very sophisticated instruments. One of those instruments might be what we call an SEM, a scanning electron microscope. This uses an electron beam, which acts like an electron flashlight. We bombard the target with high-energy electrons, and the physical and chemical composition of surfaces can be observed in detail, down to, about 100,000 magnification. We're limited to about that magnification for SEMs. We can go slightly higher than that with other kinds of microscopes. The actual image is most commonly created with an SEM by backscattered or secondary electrons, detected much like a picture tube, as these electrons are multiplied millions of times when they strike what we call a photomultiplier tube or a digital array. A nearly three-dimensional image can be generated. We like to look at things like viruses or spores, or various macromolecules can be viewed quite nicely like large enzymes with an electron microscope. And it's almost three-dimensional. The surface being scanned, however, is actually changed by the electron beam. In other words, the observation changed the actual subject being observed. Think of it like turning on your garage light to see the cockroaches. The photons from the light reach receptors on the roaches, and they react by leaving the room. Our observation with light changed the subject. The same thing happens when we scan with neutrons, photons, X-rays, or with tunneling microscopes. Tunneling microscopes are kind of neat tools today in the science of nanotechnology. We actually use that observation effect by letting the microscope push around protons until we build whatever molecule we want to. A tunneling microscope is, think of it kind of like a phonograph needle. I know some of you are too young to know what a phonograph needle is, but if you know what a DJ does with a record, if you look down very close at the end of that arm, you'll see a phonograph needle. That's similar to a scanning tunneling microscope, except the needle is only one atom large in a scanning tunneling microscope. It vibrates at a high frequency and sort of feels its way over the surface, and that feedback is converted into an image. So it's sort of like a blind man looking at something with his cane. He gets an image in his mind of what that looks like by feel. Same thing with a scanning tunneling microscope. So we actually use that observation effect for our own purposes. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's quite interesting because there is an experiment. Actually, there was a discovery. We notice that there are clouds of electrons that exist around molecules, atoms, and we can observe them, and we can capture those molecules and separate them a long way from the molecule where they came from. One of the things we noticed, if we excite these electrons into a beam or a photon beam of, say, laser light, and we shoot it at a couple of slits. If we don't bother them, we end up with a nice pattern of shadows and light on a screen. It's called an interference pattern. It appears as though the photon actually goes through both slits at the same time. Oh, I can't go into all the probabilities of this, but it can get quite confusing to read. However, if we determine the spin of that particle before it goes through the slit of that photon or that electron, guess what? The interference pattern goes away. In other words, it quits acting like a wave and starts acting like a particle. So the wave-particle duality is disturbed by our observation. Well, as if that isn't strange enough, we can take two electrons or two photons and we can separate them, capture them in a magnetic field, and we can change the spin of one of these electrons by electromagnetic charge or a light charge or a laser charge. And the interesting thing is, instantaneously, the other electron will change spin at the same time. So we call these entangled electrons or entangled photons. Nicholas Gissen proved in 1997 this is true. And you might think this is kind of strange, kind of taking an experiment to the extreme. But he separated two photons 11 kilometers apart. It might as well be 11 billion light years. Change the spin on one particle, and the spin on the other particle instantaneously changed, which defies all explanation, as this communication between particles exceeds the speed of light by many orders of magnitude. It hints to a trans-dimensional connection between these particles. We don't understand it, but we do know, and we have repeated many, many times, we can reverse the spin of one particle, and the other particle changes spin instantaneously. In other words, the observation effect we apply to one particle affects the other particle. So in physics, it obeys my slogan. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. We're talking about two particles. It gets much larger than that. Let's go backwards just a little bit. We are perhaps, well, it means that if there are entangled particles, then there is entangled energy. And if there's entangled energy, then there is entangled spirit and intelligence. It means that effects we have on each other will affect other entangled spirits, matter, and energy. Now, we can take that to the esoteric level and say, if I treat you with love and respect, that has an effect on you. And then you, in turn, affect someone else. Likewise, if I treat you with disrespect and dishonor, and I manipulate you, or I subjugate you, or I apply some pain or some evil to you, then you will pass that on to someone else, and so on and so forth, and the universe has been affected. Well, that's the esoteric level. Now let's talk about maybe more a scientific level. Let's work just a little bit backwards again. We are perhaps, as humans, the most complex organisms on the earth. I think that goes without saying. There might be squids or dolphins or whales. It could be argued or equally as complex as we are. But let's just say that because we use tools to the maximum level, that we are probably the most complex animals on the face of the earth. Maybe, in the universe. Well, almost 75% of the health research dollars spent today are spent researching the human genome. It's in the news nearly every day. We have discovered some amazing things. Now, I know you've heard in the news about T-cell research, stem cell research. These are cells that can change into any type of cell. They can change into a cell for a tooth or a bone or skin or an eye or a heart or a liver or a kidney. These cells are totally convertible. Even though they contain all the same DNA, they're a very special cell, a cell that can take on any form and any shape. Well, that's just the part you've heard of in the news. What we have discovered is that 90% of the human genome does not and could never have originated on this planet. There are capabilities in the human genome far beyond what we can demonstrate today on this planet, in this environment. Well, now this kind of shoots a lot of holes in the evolutionists that believe we crawled forth from a primordial ooze and some force or another of the environment naturally selected ourselves up into the complex being that we are. Frankly, as a physicist, I think that's a lot of felder garb. There's a bunch of holes in that theory. It doesn't mean that evolution didn't take place, but it certainly didn't take place here. Do you think we forgot how to use these capabilities? Perhaps. But most of them are just not expressed here. They could not have evolved here. Yet, with a few exceptions, nearly every tribe of mankind has the same markers. There are exceptions. There are tribes of humans, not the least of which is the Hebrew race. There are other races that have very unique markers that have not proliferated that much into other races, primarily because those races have a tendency, either through tradition or geographic location, not to mix with other races around the world. And many of these, like Aborigines, have been kept quite pristine for many, many generations and are now being researched. And we will go into these findings more and more as the weeks go on. I think you will be absolutely fascinated with the results. Well, there are more. There's more. All of these markers we find in a very complex molecule called DNA. Now, DNA is all made up of the same types of molecules called amino acids. There's actually a rather small set of these, but the combinations are practically infinite. These complex acids are made up of nearly identical atoms. I say nearly identical because there's a normal distribution of molecular weights in these different molecules, kind of like a bell curve. There's an average weight, and there are some that are a little lighter and some that are a little heavier. Do they have their own effects? I imagine so. But we, as of yet, as molecular biologists, don't know all the details of that. My own brother is a chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins, and his PhD is in molecular biology. Frankly, I think biologists are sick people. No, I'm just kidding. It's largely stamp collecting, though, compared to physics. Anyway, these nearly identical atoms are made up of subatomic particles. Now, we're still smashing atoms to discover and classify all of these, but right now, our community is pretty much settled on about 26 different particles. Now, some of them only show up for about a billionth of a second after the atomic collision, and we detect those with spectrometers, and I'm going to explain that to you in just a minute, too. Nevertheless, they exist, even though they're only there for about a billionth of a second. It's actually quite interesting once you get to see it. However, you can beam particles at each other for a month and maybe only get 5 or 6 collisions. That's a lot of cups of coffee sitting around waiting for two atoms to smash into each other. And we haven't really generated all that much power to create this. We're kind of limited on this planet, not just by governmental spending, but by just the sheer nature of energy that you would need. We can't reach the energy of a black hole or reach the energy of a supernova like we could in space. Well, we classify these particles based on a frequency signature. We detect them with a with a detector that that detects them in the form of milli electron volts or even smaller units of measure. Think of it kind of like, I'll give you a couple of examples. One is like your microwave oven. A lot of people don't understand the workings of a microwave oven, only that you don't place the household pet in them. No, they are designed to resonate at a certain frequency that is identical to the bond length between oxygen and hydrogen in the water molecule. As it turns out, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom form a specific angle, to be sure, in liquid form, but they also have a specific length based on the charge that they have and the atomic weight that they each proton is. Now, as you apply voltage or wattage to this bond, the water begins to vibrate, and the vibration creates heat, and the heat is what warms up the butter or the coffee or the roast or the bacon or whatever it is you put in your microwave ovens. That's how microwave ovens work. They're tuned to that bond length. That's why the cup doesn't get hot, but the water does. So the other example is kind of like if you own an acoustic guitar, a hollow body guitar, and you take it out of your case and lean it up in the corner of your living room and then turn the stereo on loud. Eventually, somewhere in the music, you will hear a sound like someone plucking one of those strings on that guitar. Well, actually, what happened is that guitar string absorbed a certain wavelength of energy from the room and made the sound. So if we could actually capture all the energy coming out of your stereo speakers, we would notice a drop in energy at that particular frequency of that particular string on that guitar. In essence, what we have done by measuring that drop is we have determined the exact frequency or the exact string on that guitar that vibrated. And that string will make the same sound every single time, and it will require the same wavelength of energy every time to pluck that string on that guitar. That's the same thing for atomic particles. It's the same thing for molecules. All kinds of measurements are done using this spectrometry. And that energy is the root component in every atom, every molecule, and in every one of us. It is all the same. Even though our DNA is made up of different molecules, different atoms in different arrangements, the subatomic particles are all identical. The energy is all identical. And so somehow, on an energy level, we are all identical. However, we are not all the same. So what is the difference? Well, the arrangement, of course, of those genetics, but even if we looked fairly alike, we would be different because there's another component to the human animal. There is the spirit. Now, we'll discuss that a little more in another section. But what I'm really trying to get at is trying to prove that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. You can see how much thought I've poured into this, and I'm trying to transfer it to you. Now, we're going to conduct a little experiment. We physicists love to do experiments. Before we do the experiment, I'm going to have another little commercial, because we've got to pay some bills. And then we will begin the experiment. And it'll come with a disclaimer and a warning because it can be risky. Well, the arc of millions of years offers new light and discovery on the creation of the Earth. It is the Intelligent Design Handbook. Forward Magazine calls it the most comprehensive book ever written on the creation of the Earth. There is more solid evidence and scholarly meat between its covers than any book in print to date. But its writing style is easy and beautiful, and it's double-spaced. And it's available at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure to spell that A-R-K, not A-R-C, like Noah's Ark. Or you can find it at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstore. Now, for the experiment. Now, you people that are driving, I want you to be very careful, because this experiment can make your mind wander. So I want you to concentrate on what you're doing. If you become too enwrapped in the experiment, turn the radio down or switch to some music for about 4 or 5 minutes, and we'll be finished, and you can come back. But here's the experiment. What I want you to do is listen very closely, and you can follow this exercise. Everyone can do this. I want you to go back in your mind to when you were 10 years old. I want you to stand on the street where you used to live, and I want you to look at the outside of your house. You can see the color and the yard, and you can see the shape of the shingles and the arrangement of whatever you might have in the yard, if it's toys or lawn furniture or whatever. I want you to walk up to your old house when you were 10 years old, and I want you to knock on the front door. Now, the person that comes to the front door is going to be your 10-year-old self. So you open the door from the inside, and you can see each other. And I want you to say hello. Now, your 10-year-old self is going to invite you in the house. And whether it's a girl really doesn't matter, because you're going to invite yourself back to the bedroom, and I want you to show off your favorite toys. If it's model airplanes, if it's music, if it's matchbox cars, or if it's Barbie dolls, I want you to show off that collection. You can see that collection as clearly as day. Now, it's just about dinner time. So I want you to invite yourself to dinner. And so your 10-year-old self is going to take your modern-day self to the kitchen or to the dining room, wherever it is that you normally sit down for supper. And I want you to sit down with your family. Now, your family, they can't see you. You can see them. The only person in the room that can see you is your 10-year-old self. Taste the food. Look at the arrangement of food. Remember what it was like to have spaghetti or lasagna or pot roast or whatever it is that you like to eat when you're at home. Now supper's quickly over because this is sort of a dream state we're in, and it's time for you to leave. And so you take your 10-year-old self, takes you back to the front door, and you open the front door, and your 10-year-old self is standing in the doorway. You walk out onto the front porch, and you get to turn around. And you get to say one thing to your 10-year-old self. You determine at this moment what that one thing is. Because you are going to bring it to the future, to where you are now. Now that's the experiment. What we did is your past self received something from you that you have now carried forward to the present. You have been changed forever. Now you see that every word that you say, every deed that you do or don't do, will have an effect in the past or in the present, and it will affect the future. Whether you are entangled with that soul or not, they might be entangled with someone else or many people. You had an effect on them and will affect others. The effect you had on yourself will also affect others. Whether you make them angry, cut them off, harm them in some way, or love them, care for them, show compassion toward them, all of these will have an effect on the universe. So I want you to take it moment by moment and affect the universe on purpose. In here, in X Squared Radio, we try to do this in a positive way every day. And now we'll move on to section two. If you'll remember, last week we established section two as a section on UFOs. Now, I also stated that I have not personally seen a UFO, although I cannot deny the plethora of testimony and blurred photographs of various craft that may or may not be unidentified, may or may not be real. I cannot deny all of that. I have not experienced it for myself. And though I have vicariously lived through other scientists, other testimonies, even very well done movies and TV and radio programs, I personally have not experienced it. Doesn't mean I'm a doubting Thomas. It just means I'm a scientist, and I like to have something to put a pin into and stick on my sample board. It's just the stamp collector in me that wants to see that. So, in our section on UFOs tonight, we're going to talk about a fantastic voyage that's going taking place next summer. I have been invited to join 39 of scientists on an expedition to the Hollow Earth. That's right. I will be able to provide you with some particulars tonight, but some of these details will be kept secret until we return, for obvious reasons. The expedition leaders have done tremendous research into the probable location of a northern opening to the Hollow Earth. No one, and I mean no one, has ever gone where we are going. Now, I've read Admiral Byrd's account of what he claims he saw on his historic flight into the opening some 50 years ago. We don't have one photo or one piece of factual evidence from that or from a government expedition that supposedly was made about 20 years ago to approximately the same region. For some reason, it appears when the government gets involved in these kinds of trips, we just get a redacted version of the truth. Well, each scientist on this expedition is going at his own expense, and it is expensive. We're also going to conduct experiments as the trip proceeds. It will take 21 days. This is what I mean when we're going somewhere where no one has gone before. We are traveling on a nuclear-powered icebreaker. Not by aircraft, not by dog sled, not by a nuclear submarine under the polar caps. No, we're going to plow through the ice until we reach a specific location, which we have predetermined. It's about an 890-square-mile spot, where mathematically and through satellite observation we have determined we are most likely to find this opening. Now, the cost for me and my equipment will be about $50,000. That's a lot of money. We scientists crumbs with the sparrows. $50,000 is a lot of money. And that doesn't include the ancillary travel expenses or any wages. It only covers the cost of transportation on the icebreaker and the cost of building my equipment. Now, here's what I'm building. I'm responsible for building a radio spectrometer, which is my area of expertise, to measure the magnetic fields of the Earth. I'm building a gamma and alpha particle spectrometer, not like a Geiger counter. A Geiger counter is just a tube with some gas in it, and when a radioactive event occurs, there's a small scintillation. It's picked up by a single wire that goes through the tube, and you just get an electric tick. But you have no idea what caused the tick. A gamma spectrometer can tell the exact frequency of that scintillation, and we can tell what it is. If it's uranium, or if it's a radon, or if it's thorium or cobalt, we can tell exactly what it is. This will be important as we measure what might be an ion flow out of an opening in the center of the Earth. And we will also be purchasing a quadrupole filter. For those of you that know what a quadrupole filter is, it's kind of like a 35,000 RPM turbine vacuum that sucks air through a tiny pinhole, creating a tremendous vacuum. And normally it would be a straight shot from the pinhole to the detector, but we put four charged poles poles, two positive and two negative, and then we lace that with a radio wave so that we only get a specific sampling of molecular weight. It's kind of a down and dirty mass spectrometer, so we can tell the molecular weight of what hits the detector, and the smaller the molecule, the smaller the possibilities of what the molecule could be. That way we can tell if it's natural gas or what kind of gas is coming out, and we can do headspace analysis of salt water and ice on a very rapid basis without having to have a picky, sensitive gas chromatograph out in the zero-degree weather. Now, there is a possibility that we will locate the opening, or at least the depression in the sea, which leads to an opening below. Now, some of the scientists believe there will be an actual opening through which a ship can sail into the core of the Earth. And some believe, and I think that I'm probably in this camp, some believe it will be an acceleration of the curvature of the Earth, much like the stem area of an apple, where the ocean can be penetrated with a probe on a cable and passed into the core of the Earth. At any rate, it is going to be exceedingly exciting. Not many people get to go to the North Pole, and least ways on a nuclear-powered icebreaker. I don't know how easy it's going to be to sleep on an icebreaker, but we're going to find out. They tell me in the summertime that it's up to about 0 degrees in this region, which is not too bad. After all, I'm a Scot. I'm kind of used to that temperature. Well, let's see what the geology says. Interesting. This is some of the data that's out there right now about the geology of the center of the Earth. Everyone knows what seismic exploration is. You may have even witnessed it. In the oil business, exploration used to be done by setting off explosives and recording the sound waves as they bounce off structures deep in the Earth, kind of like a dynamite MRI of the Earth. That's the way it was done before I perfected ground probing radar. Now it's all done by radio waves, the same as it is being done on Mars right now. That's the technology that I pioneered in the 80s, and it's very, very effective. These long sonic waves from a seismic explosion provide a map of the structure of the strata beneath us for about 20,000 feet. Openings or fissures in the ground, they're pretty easy to find when you use these kinds of methods. The tradition was to drill into these voids, like big caves or big pools that might exist there based on the sound waves coming back, and it yielded about 1 in 10 drilling attempts resulted in oil. Of course, once they hit the oil, then they could drill a whole bunch more holes and pump the oil out at excessive rates. But, of course, my ground probing radar had a 100% effective ratio in 9 different states. Of course, we only went down to depths of about 6,500 feet, so we never tried it beyond that. Well, these geophones, these seismic detectors, have been placed all over the Earth to listen for earthquakes. Some of them still use the Richter scale. Now, usually we electronically convert that now, but the old-style Richter instrument was actually a heavy mass needle, somewhat stable, and the Earth would move underneath the needle, and then those signals could be transferred to paper. Now we do it electronically, and we do it with accelerometers that are bolted or welded or fused to large masses which are attached to the Earth. Now we pick up all kinds of other vibrations, like trucks going by and small earthquakes of 1 or 2 or 3 on the Richter scale. We're talking about the big ones. So when a large one occurs, say in Bangladesh, equipment in Los Angeles picks up the vibrations through the Earth. So the result is a pretty good map of the interior of the Earth. You get an effective explosion on the other side of the planet, and the vibrations go through the Earth and reach these phones, and we can tell based on the amount of transit time and the angle of its arrival, what the inside of the Earth looks like. So the wave emanates from the epicenter, kind of like a hammer smacking into a piece of ice, to all points in all directions until it's blocked by something. Now, a wave, a sonic wave like that, can be reflected or it can be absorbed. Reflected waves give us a pretty good image. It's sort of like a bat sending out sonic waves and listening back for details about its surroundings or potential prey, and they're pretty good at it. But absorbed waves provide only a void in the picture, sort of a blackness or a clear spot. Well, there are two things that can absorb a wave passing through the center of the Earth. The first, a solid metal core, mostly like iron. The second is a gap between the core and the lower crust. Now, the tradition says that the core of the Earth is a solid iron core rotating in a sea of molten rock called magma, with a solid crust on the outside on which we live. The magnetic flux flowing through the Earth indicates that the core and the crust rotate at slightly different speeds, thus generating the magnetism, much like a generator. It works pretty well. Well, the hollow Earth theory says that there may indeed be a solid core, but that is probably a pale and dense star rotating in an open chamber, perhaps 2,000 miles in diameter. Now, keep in mind two things, just to kind of put this in perspective for you. First, the space shuttle and most weather satellites fly only about 200 to 240 miles high. Secondly, we have only drilled a little less than 5 miles into the crust. We don't have any clue what the Earth looks like beyond that point. Well, the Earth is about 20,000 miles in circumference if you were to fly around it. This means that the Earth is about 6,300 miles in diameter. If we have accounted for only 10 miles of that diameter through drilling, and we have only seismic data that shows a hollow core much better than it shows a solid core, then what is the likelihood that someone or something has made use of that space? Especially if there's some form of heat and light inside that core. Well, now your mind is beginning to open. You see, if there was a star, even a dull one, in the center of the Earth, it could be 100 miles in diameter. And there would still be enough room for thousands of miles of space before getting to an inner crust upon which perhaps another race lives. And then 100 miles or so in which there is a magma flowing, and then another 40 or 50 or 80 miles thick crust upon which we live. You would still get the magnetic field, the core rotating at a different speed than the crust. You'd still get the same mass that we have for the Earth, and it would mathematically match perfectly the seismic data that we get from these geophones. Strangely enough, every single time there's a major quake, the data doesn't quite match the solid core theory. There's always an anomaly. There's always an exception. There are rules written to make up for these exceptions. Shadows, phantoms, reflections. But for the hollow core, it matches every single time. Well, we are going to take the trip. We are going to find out on our own, by direct observation, like real scientists. We are going to see for ourselves what is there. If it's not there, we will bring back the most wonderful data proving so you ever saw. If it is there, it will be the most incredible discovery in the history of the Earth. Now, there's one more piece of evidence I'd like to leave with you tonight in this section. You know what the Aurora Borealis is, the Northern Lights. We've certainly seen a ton of them lately, because since the 5th of September, there have been 9 X-class solar flares from a single sunspot, number 808, on the sun. Now, some of those weren't pointed directly at our Earth, but they were close enough that the solar wind and the particles and the cosmic radiation made a very nice aurora borealis, all the way down as low as Phoenix, Arizona, has been photographed. Now, of course, we've only been measuring these for about 30 years, but in that time, 9 solar flares have never happened out of the same sunspot. But now, sunspots have been counted for a long, long time. They've been counted probably since the 1600s. And normally in an amount of time of, oh, say, 50 years, there might be 20,000 sunspots. Currently, right now, we are supposed to be in a low cycle, a cycle of very few sunspots. However, the number of X-class flares is phenomenally high, and solar physicists don't have a clue why that is happening. Soon, in a few years, around 2007, a little bit beyond, we're going to enter a peak of sunspots. And it's a 50-50 chance what we're going to see at that time. We're either going to see an increase in solar flare activity, or we're going to see a decrease in solar flare activity. It will be very interesting to see if there's a correlation. Now, one of the interesting things that we've done, there are satellite images of the Earth during one of these showers, and it shows a very neat aurora. If you want to see one, we'll post a film on X Squared Radio website tomorrow, and you can view it for yourself. Our science expedition team gathered some video of an aurora that was very strange. The aurora looked proper, except that there was no solar wind whatsoever, and no solar flare that caused it. None. It was not to arrive for another 2 weeks. This ion flow, the one that lit up the ionosphere with an aurora borealis, this ion flow came from within the Earth, straight out of an opening at the pole that caused it. It showered the ionosphere from underneath, and you can see it in the film. Now, do you believe that our expedition will indeed bring back the greatest discovery in the history of the world? There may indeed be a star with a 1,000-mile atmosphere around it, around which an inner crust sandwiches a magma layer between that world and our world. Pretty interesting. All right. No matter what church you attend, no matter what your ancestry or your present nationality, you have a history and a lineage of which you might not be aware. You are children of the stars. The real ET is in the mirror. If you want to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you might be going from here, you need to read The Arc of Millions of Years this year. It's available at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores, but if you want to get the free audio version of the book, you should purchase the book at the website, www.arcofmillionsofyears.com, and we're going to run a little special. We're going to give you free shipping if you buy the book during the radio show tonight. And because we've had some server problems out in the state of California this evening, we are going to extend this free shipping offer until this time tomorrow. So you'll have 24 hours to go to the website and purchase the book, far cheaper than you can purchase it in the bookstore, and you get free shipping. Also, what we are offering as an incentive, a bonus, we are in the process of recording the book in audio. Now, there are 2 chapters on the website that you can download for free. You can stream it from the website for nothing, or you can right-click it, save it, burn a CD, and listen to it in your car. But we're going to go a step further than that tonight. What we're going to offer you, if you purchase the book in the next 24 hours, we're going to offer you the entire book on a 5-CD set, pre-recorded for you, mailed to your house at our expense. No shipping, no tax, no charge whatsoever. You will have a paper copy of the book in which you can make notes, you can stick things you like, and you will have a CD version of the book that you can listen to in your car or truck. Now, that is a great, great value. I know some books, just the audiobook alone, is $65. But The Ark of Millions of Years paperback can be bought for $19.95, and the hardback complete with full-color dust cover for $26.95 at www.arkofmillionsofyears.com. Even if you've bought the book before the audiobook was available, if you request it by registering at the website, and you can do that two ways. You can register message board, or you can fill out the form and send us your email address along with your receipt number from where you purchased the book, and we will send you the entire book on CD, ready to play in your car or truck, free. So make sure to take advantage of that. Okay, we are now going to go into section 3, and we call this section 3 the Nephilim. This is quite important. We cover the Nephilim in depth in the book. We dispel all myths and solve all the mysteries about the Nephilim. We cover the tribes, the origin, the mission, what they look like in stone carvings as well as ancient art. And so in this section, we talk about the activities of the Nephilim, their mission, and what they're trying to accomplish. Tonight, the section on the Nephilim, we are going to cover the mark of the beast. Now, we have come to understand this as a mark on the hand or in the forehead of such perfect identity that a man will not be able to buy, sell, or trade without it. It's clearly described in many, many writings. It's alluded to strongly in the Bible. Many people my age and even older and younger are fully aware of what the mark of the beast is. We have been in fear of it. We have are afraid of one world governments because of it. And tonight we're going to share with you just how close this technology is and how willing we will be to accept it. Now, this technology has been completely perfected in the past few years right under our noses. Millions of farm animals, pets, trucks, trailers, shipping containers, cars, cell phones, and even credit cards have been fitted with small integrated circuits. These circuits can store about 8 megabytes of all kinds of information. They even have GPS locator signatures for various security reasons. There are companies today that you can install these units in your automobile. If it is stolen, it is activated, and the police department can drive straight to that car. They can get to within 15 feet of that car in just a matter of moments. Now, besides this, and this is the obvious stuff, besides this, we have been using small barcodes for discounts on shopping. Whenever you go to Food Lion or Winn-Dixie or Vons, you can choose to scan a small barcode key tag to receive additional discounts. Who doesn't like a discount? Come on. Well, when you scan that little card, your purchase is sent to retailers and wholesalers so they can better target their advertising dollars. Or so they say. It makes sense, doesn't it? This information is very valuable, and it is sold for money by the grocer to anyone who wants it. Of course, if one wanted to, they could compare your purchase habits from week to week. One could draw conclusions on the size and gender of your family, your body weight, or any illnesses you may harbor. They'll know what areas of the country buy the most orange juice, or yogurt, or Black Angus beef. whatever they want to know, it's on those discount cards. All fairly benign, all with the best intentions, I am sure. Now, who carries cash anymore? I personally have found it to be biodegradable. If I put it in my pocket, it disappears. I might as well crack my window on the highway and take the bills, 20s, 50s, whatever, and just slide them right out the window, because that's how far they go. They just disappear. I prefer to use a debit card for just about everything. I can track my purchases. Sometimes I get kind of a rebate on it. It's easy at the end of the month where all my money went, and I don't have to worry about just about anything. I can buy everything from a hot dog to a new computer if I wish. And yes, I have been the victim of identity theft. I made an online purchase from a company in California, and within 8 hours, my entire checking account was emptied through ATM in Scarborough via a foreign country. Well, the bank, of course, replaced all my money, and I was able to weather that just fine. But the idea behind this is that the technology now exists to tie all of this information together. And now we have the mix of a system we will call the Mark of the Beast. Now, how easy will we accept this? Well, the debit cards are pretty easy to accept. The pet marking chips and the shipping container and the cell phone chips, those are pretty easy to accept. But what do you think would make us want to put it under our skin, behind our ear, or in our hand or something? What in the world would possess people to do that? Well, herein lies the master sales job. There's already underway a tremendous campaign to sell society on this kind of identification. First of all, identity theft, you hear about it every single day as the fastest growing crime, the most expensive crime in all of America. But there's more. There's a lot more. It will be sold to America as a way to finally, once and for all, stop terrorism. We will be able to prevent the movement of money, the assembling of armies, the movement of expensive goods, key items that could be used to build weapons. All of these things will be able to be tracked. And certainly that is a good and noble thing. It will also allow us to recover missing children who are abducted. We comb the country, we comb the world for missing people. Millions of missing people every year. We can't find them. This will be, you could find anybody in a matter of hours. All you need is a GPS and a way of tracking that particular chip. It's as easy as finding your Afghan lost in the middle of Beverly Hills. No problem. The third thing that it will be used for is to unify currency. We want to move to electronic currency. It costs so much money to maintain cash. We just have to do away with all this. It's an unnecessary expense. Who needs it anyway? Besides, once you pull the cash off the street, you now solve one more problem. You solve drugs. No one is going to want to deal drugs with a debit card. Without cash, the drug market dries up. Also, counterfeiting goes away. So all of these crimes become solved with the Mark of the Beast. Oh, they might not call it the Mark of the Beast. We'll call it the super identity or some such as that. And that pretty much concludes our show for tonight. I would like to leave one final bill-paying commercial with you. If you visit the website at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com, please register for the newsletter. The process is very simple, and we will give you all kinds of discounts and bonus material available from time. Of course, the Arc of Millions of Years is the greatest story on the universe. We want you to read it or listen to it this year, because in January, Volume 2 comes out. The next 8 years will bring about more changes to our world than you can imagine. You will need this information now more than ever. Don't miss a single one of our programs, and please read the book this year, available anytime at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, not A-R-C, and during normal business hours at Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores. So we want you to remember who you are, and we want you to go forward without fear. Next Wednesday, we are going to cover some of this information in a lot more detail. You won't want to miss it. We're going to discuss one world governments, and we're going to discuss many other very interesting things. And we're going to interview my intrepid explorer partner, Dean Ford. You will not want to miss this. Remember who you are. Remember that we care for one another. We are trying our best to reach this metamorphosis where we become earthlings, caring for one another and reaching for the stars. Remember, this is X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Good evening.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.